Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midterm elections are tomorrow. Many are anticipating a sharp reshuffling of power in Washington. Democrats are out trying to hold on. Republicans are out trying to take over. Tomorrow, voters will decide. Today, we'll look at a range of possible Election Day outcomes and what they might mean for policy in Washington. This hour, On Point agendas, Republican, Democrat, and the White House after tomorrow's big vote. You can join the conversation. What do you see coming post-midterms from the Capitol on taxes, health care, jobs? What's the agenda you're fighting for today, voting for tomorrow? Joining me now from Washington is Chuck Babington, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Chuck, it's good to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
With us as well from Washington, Glenn Thrush from Politico. Glenn, welcome. Very good of you to be here.
Hi.
So here we are. I mean, we're all hearing every hour on the hour and more than that what the polls are saying about what may come out of tomorrow's vote. Who knows what it will actually be, but there's a good chance we'll see a Republican majority in the House, possibly in the Senate, though people are saying maybe, maybe not. Chuck Babington, here we are looking at what's been promised by Republicans if they take power, if there's one House or two. I mean, they're talking about repealing Obamacare, rolling back the new financial regulations, maybe rolling back the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. But what can they actually do if they get one majority, let's say?
Well, Tom, they can't do very much. The main thing they can do is obstruct. Obviously, as you said, the betting is that they will take the majority in the House, probably not in the Senate, but the Senate should be close. And, of course, we'll still have a Democratic president with veto powers. In terms of what they'll do, there's more holes left in that than there are things that have been filled in. That short list you just went through is pretty close to the specifics that have been out there. You know, the Republicans have a campaign priority here. Their goal is to win as many seats in the House and Senate as they can, and it's sort of then they'll worry about what they do. That's not unheard of. You know, Democrats have done similar things when they've been behind. But really, they've given very few specifics about what they would try to do with the House majority if they get it.
Let's listen to their messages, the messages from both sides over the weekend. Here's John Boehner's weekly Republican address. This was on Saturday, saying that Republicans, if they get victories, will steer the country to a better track.
We're ready to cut spending to pre-stimulus, pre-bailout levels, saving taxpayers $100 billion almost immediately. And we're ready to put in place strict budget caps that limit spending from here on out to ensure that Washington no longer is on the spending binge.
And here's President Obama at Cleveland State University in Ohio on Sunday giving a final push for incumbent Democratic governor there, Ted Strickland.
Now, we know the jobs and businesses tomorrow will end up in countries that educate their workers best, that build the best infrastructure, that have the strongest commitment to research and technology. I want that nation to be the United States of America. I want that taking place right here in Ohio, right here in Cleveland. That's how we're going to rebuild.
Glenn Thrush in Washington, just look forward with us. People are making up their minds, but there will be consequences. It may not be a big enough hold by either party for a great big new agenda, but what do you see coming out of this, given the likely outcomes, we're now told, for tomorrow's vote, Glenn?
Well, it's so funny. This is like a World Series in which every game is a blowout, but each team sort of splits the blowouts. I think we're getting sort of this radical approximation of a moderate balance of power in the country. We just keep swinging back and forth, and I would sort of only half jokingly say that Obama now has the Republicans exactly where he wants them.
Meaning what?
Provided they take over the House, he has them with their toe in the pool. For the past 22 months, the president has essentially commanded a sort of an unworkable supermajority. He hasn't been able to get exactly what he wants, and he hasn't had any participation from the Republicans. And I think now he's got them on the hook in terms of governance. So, as Chuck so aptly put, they had better figure out some way to translate this very broad sort of campaign agenda into something resembling governance, or in 2 years we're going to be talking about a dynamic that's very different.
Well, maybe, and we'll look at that. Of course, it could just be a two-year drumbeat toward the presidential elections. Mitch McConnell has said as much, that his primary goal is to see Barack Obama not seated for a second term. But Glenn, what about, let's just take agenda items here, spending. You heard John Boehner right there in that tape, you know, saying that we're ready to cut spending to pre-stimulus, pre-bailout levels, save taxpayers $100 billion almost immediately. What about on the spending front? Given the rules of Congress, could a Republican majority in the House alone or even with a slim Senate majority do that?
No, and another sort of lesser notice encounter over the weekend was Eric Cantor, the minority whip, soon to be John Boehner's number two, perhaps as majority leader, was asked on a conference call this weekend whether or not he would opt for a government shutdown. Would he hold up spending bills?
We saw when Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton faced off.
And he said somewhat less than unequivocally, no. If Republicans play this gambit of sort of shutting down the government and this obstruction, which has worked for them enormously well in the minority, is perceived as transmitted to governance, I think they're going to have a lot of trouble. That said, there needs to be some structure figured out by the White House and the Republicans on the Hill to negotiate these issues. I mean, I think this is what, if you look at the relative approval numbers of both parties, they're both in the toilet, and I think the American people, taken in the aggregate, really want to see folks get together and not shut things down.
Chuck Babington, on spending, I mean, there will be appropriations bills. Do they only have the nuclear option of shutting down government? Could we see some action here by a bolstered Republican presence on Capitol Hill to go after spending somehow or not?
Glenn made an important point that if the Republicans take control of the House, they do have some responsibility for making government work. The voters will hold them partly responsible. And if they don't get the House, which would be a surprise, the Democrats, again, will be totally responsible for the government. We don't think that'll happen. So if John Boehner is Speaker, then the Republicans have to play ball to some degree. And when they did use the nuclear option back in 1995, when Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took control and Bill Clinton was the president, it was a disaster. They shut down the government. The public mainly blamed the Republicans, and the Democrats had a huge bounce back in the next election. So they can play hardball if they want, but probably what would happen is they would have to reach some type of accord on spending. And the other thing to say, Tom, is that the Republicans don't have a great record on cutting spending. They often talk about it. They posture themselves as the party of low spending. But if you look at the record when Ronald Reagan and both Bushes were president, and at times that Republicans controlled one or both houses of Congress, there wasn't much spending cutting at all, and we saw the deficit climb very often.
What Glenn, about this, we're not out of the woods on the economy. People still wonder if it could stall out, and perhaps from some Democrats' point of view, need some more stimulation. If the Republicans gain the House, let's say, Glenn, would President Obama have the option to come again with some kind of stimulus? Those have been put in many different ways over the last 2 years. Would that still be an option, or would that be closed off by a Republican House majority?
I think that's clear, that any sense of a continued sort of stimulus that requires budgetary expenditure is completely off the table. Remember, the big lingering issue that's out there right now, and Republicans, I think, refer this as sort of a hidden stimulus, is this question of the Bush-era tax cuts. We still have a battle looming on that. My sense is that we're not going to see that dealt with in the lame duck. It's going to push into the beginning of the year. But, you know, that's been, to a certain extent, the dynamic is shifting, but it has been shifted. This has been, you know, in the same way that sort of stock markets have futures, this result has somewhat been factored into the Obama administration's calculations for the past 4 to 6 months or so. The age of these big legislative, big-ticket items, the stimulus, health care reform, regulatory overhaul, are over, and I think the White House is clearly going to be in the duck and cover mode for a while.
There may be a stall out on those, but Chuck, one way or another, Bush tax cuts will expire, and they'll either be, you know, sort of changed or massaged. Something will happen here, whether in the lame duck session or not. What do you see coming on taxes if it's a... Let's go to that Republican House majority scenario.
I think there will be tremendous pressure to extend the tax cuts. Remember, all along, even from President Obama, all he has proposed was to roll back those big tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, those families making a quarter of $1 million a year and higher, and even that they were not able to do, you know, with the congressional majority. And as for the stimulus, the biggest problem is that it's just not very popular with the public. Even though most economists will say that it did have some good effect, the public was never sold on that, and it has a bad reputation.
But if the White House loses Congress, loses the House, Chuck, what can they do on taxes? If nothing's done, I guess we go all the way back. So there's going to be a call for some kind of action. I mean, they'll have to engineer some kind of outcome here.
Right, Tom. I think what they'll do is extend those tax cuts for everyone. They'll call it temporary, depending on how long temporary is. And then when that, let's say it's a year or whatever, when that period expires, we'll have to look at what the economy is doing. You know, most economists predict a very slow, gradual recovery, so we can't expect it to be dramatically better. But then there might be another push to roll back the tax cuts on the wealthiest Americans. Obama did campaign on that issue very strongly in 2008, but it just never he never was able to accomplish it.
Glenn, just 20 seconds before a break here, but does a House Republican majority tomorrow mean to you the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans go on?
Yes, I totally agree with Chuck, and I think a perfect time for the Obama folks to have them to revisit this debate would be, I don't know, the summer of 2012, right before the presidential election.
Yeah, no doubt, and we may well see that. Glenn Thrush with Politico, Charles Babington with the Associated Press, both covering the White House. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Chuck, Glenn, lots of feedback here online. We've got Peter says if the Republicans do take the House, even the Senate, it may well mark the beginning of their demise. An angry electorate's already been energized by the high expectations generated in 08. Republicans have no apparent programs to offer. We'll look at that. William says, I hope liberals, progressives start to listen to the American people, become less radical, work with the Republicans for massive spending cuts. And Jason says, if Republicans do well, nothing will be done. Our economy and our lives will swirl down a partisan toilet. Oh, boy, it's sort of a range of expectations and hopes there. Peter Baker joins us as well now from Washington, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Peter, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. Do you see gridlock or do you see change? If Republicans get one, maybe two houses of Congress, what do you see coming, Peter?
Well, I think obviously you're going to see a period of 2 years in which you have a lot of conflicts. No question about that. The Republicans have proposed to do things during this election campaign season that are, you know, exact opposite of what President Obama would support, and he's got the veto pen. So whether it be one house or two, there's going to be, you know, clearly some headbutting when it comes to things like repealing health care or things like that. On the other hand, you know, when you have a divided government, there are moments we've seen in history where there are periods of productivity in which they can, in fact, put aside the basis of their own parties in order to come together, whether it be on welfare reform, for instance, between President Clinton and Newt Gingrich in 1996 or other examples like that. The question is whether the environment will allow each side to make that kind of accommodation to come together on big issues.
Peter, do you see any, can you name one, where the new math of Washington and the political dynamics might bring Democrats and Republicans to work together for, you know, some active agenda push forward?
Well, one thing that the president identifies, for instance, is education reform. The next year they're going to try to reauthorize the main education law in this country, and some of the reform ideas that he's put forward are kinds of things that Republicans and centrists over the years have favored, accountability ideas. So there's room for agreement on that, just like George Bush and the Democrats came together on No Child Left Behind. Harder, obviously, would be deficit spending. The Fiscal Deficit Commission that the president appointed comes back December 1st with what will no doubt be a lot of very controversial ideas. That's going to require both sides to trust each other if they're going to do some of those. And then immigration is another area where they're going to at least fight it out. I don't know that there's a lot of room for compromise given the current polarization on that issue.
We'll look at those and more. Let's go to our listeners. Wyndham, Connecticut. Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was at the John Stewart rally, and, you know, I'm a center-right guy. But I believe we got to really take it down a notch, as he says, because, you know, I'm on the David Stockman bandwagon that you know, the two parties have been selling us a big line of malarkey, and this national debt is a serious matter for our country. And you know, but the right, and I'm kind of on the right, you know, there's this religious canon that there's no new taxes, and it's become this, like, you know, a canon that we can't raise taxes. And we're going to have to all take a big bite of this sandwich to get us out of the ditch.
On the spending side, on the revenue, taxes side, both, you're saying, maybe.
Yes, exactly, on the spending and on the taxation side. I think David Stockman has had it, is right on. You know, the parties are going to have to learn to talk like adults and see the problem for what it is.
Stephen, you say you're center-right. Do you see that coming from a new strengthened Republican/Tea Party presence in Washington after tomorrow?
You know, not really, because the expediency of the next election. You know, I think they're gonna go down the path of I'm a moderate center right New Englanders. I mean, the new, you know,
they're all gone.
Maybe Brown will, but Brown is only one guy, you know.
Yeah, Stephen, I appreciate your call. I mean, Glenn, let's talk for a second about what we saw. We saw Glenn Beck in Washington with his rally a couple of months ago, and yesterday Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. The big sort of message, after all the, you know, sort of good humor, was we've got to tone down the rhetoric and really get to work on our problems in this country. Do you see that as a dynamic that may emerge here, Glenn, or, you know, does it have a snowball's chance?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of this depends on the unemployment rate and people's personal economic outlook. I mean, the one thing is, we're talking about Washington. What's occurring right now is not a Washington phenomenon. You're dealing with sort of this economic despair and anxiety out there that's really unprecedented in all of our lifetimes. So there's a great deal that's out of the control of whoever is in control in Washington. That said, I think there are some reasons for optimism about a potential coming age of at least some moderation. And that is, you know, despite the rhetoric you're hearing out of John Boehner in the House, this is a guy who really has a reputation internally as being someone who's willing to compromise. I recall seeing John Boehner in tears on the floor of the House of Representatives when the bank bailout bill was going to go down. And you have people like Roy Blunt.
And he voted for it, of course. Yes. He helped push it through under President Bush.
Yes, and there's a great apprehension among Eric Cantor and some of his Boehner's lieutenants about being perceived as the party of no. The other, I think, potential tailwind for moderation is the fact that midterms tend to increase participation by the extremes in both parties, and 2012 will be a presidential year, and I think there will be a look at a larger electorate and really an attempt to solidify the gains the Republicans made with white independents, and they don't want this sort of radical governance.
Chuck Babington, how do you see it, whether it's the sort of mojo out of Glenn Beck's rally or the Jon Stewart rally yesterday? I mean, can you imagine a kind of period where everybody says, my gosh, these problems are so enormous that we've got to steady the boat here, cut the rhetoric a little bit, get to work together? After all, we've heard John Boehner just in the last week or two saying no compromise, no compromise.
Yes, Tom, and the reason he's doing that is all of Glenn's points are valid, but at the same time, there's going to be a big push from the other direction. You know, voters overwhelmingly say they want the parties to work together, but then voters act in ways that work against that. So you look at Utah, where Senator Bob Bennett was a very conservative Republican, but the Republican Party threw him out because he wasn't conservative enough and because he sometimes talked to Democrats. In Alaska, Lisa Murkowski was denied the Republican nomination. Tea Party or Joe Miller won, again, because she was seen as too moderate. You see quite a few races in the House where it looks like we're going to get, again, Tea Party-type candidates who campaigned on, you know, not compromising their very conservative positions with Democrats. And so there's going to be tremendous pressure on John Boehner. John Boehner, assuming he is Speaker, is going to be in a very, very difficult position because for exactly the points that Glenn laid out, there will be an incentive for him to try to show cooperation and accomplish something by working with Obama and the Democrats. At the same time, he's going to have quite a number in his Republican caucus who are going to say, you know, I ran on holding the line and not cooperating with these liberals, and I'll be darned if I'm going to vote, you know, in a way that goes against that.
Peter Baker at the New York Times, White House correspondent there, you've reported in depth on sort of inside politics of the first, a year and a half, going on 2 years of the Obama presidency, and what the president's taken away from that. Now, there's been a lot of Republican pushback during that time. How do you see the president's learning going into a post-midterm politics where the Republicans have a strengthened president on Capitol Hill? How's he likely to respond?
Well, he's going to have to make some choices, obviously. He already recognizes, I think, that the more transformational type of policies that he's pushed are now done. He's had his chance to do that, at least in this term, health care and financial re-regulation and so forth. And that what he's going to need to do in the next 2 years is focus more on implementation of that agenda and defending it against Republican attacks or reversals in the courts. So he looks at the next 2 years as being a different phase in his presidency already. The question is whether he can maneuver to the middle in a way that, again, not to keep citing President Clinton's example, but as President Clinton did to an extent. The difference, of course, is that President Clinton came into office with as a self-identified
New Democrat.
Right. Mm-hmm. He was the head of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and so forth. So it was already his idea to kind of move his party more toward the middle. That's not been something that President Obama has talked about. He styles himself as a pragmatist, but not necessarily as a centrist, per se. And we're going to test the limits of that pragmatism, I think, coming up.
We'll look at what that may mean in particular issues. John in Tullahoma, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hi. This is John Lurch from Tullahoma. There was a program on this morning on actually on your competitor, the TV, on which they were talking about the lack of civility and loss of civility. I think that it can be attributed to the notion of trickle-down economics, that there's this class that is better than all the rest of us, and that they're the ones who are driving everything. And I think that everyone has sort of bought into that enough. Even I believe it to a certain extent, but and so that everyone sort of buys into it, and eventually we all say, yes, massa, and eventually we all sort of explode. And so that I think the result of a Republican victory will just be more incivility in the country.
There's an expectation of incivility. We'll look at it, John. Let's get one more. Rudy in Conway, South Carolina. Rudy, you're on.
Hello. I just wonder, the polls have been predicting this and that, and I just wonder how many times in these elections have the polls been wrong, that they have predicted an outcome that was entirely opposite of what? I feel that they don't take into account the hundreds and thousands of people who lost their homes, the hundreds and thousands who lost their jobs, and I am quite sure that their vote will reflect a difference than what the polls say.
Let us pick it up right there. Glenn Thrush, what about it? You know, the sort of drumbeat is big Republican victories in the House, maybe even a wave, Senate maybe in play. Could that be wrong?
No. I think there's going to be an enormous Republican wave in the House. I mean, Gallup this morning came out with what should frighten the heck out of Democrats, a sense that that things have gotten so wild that they sort of can't be anticipated. The range is somewhere between 40 and 80, 39 is needed to turn over the House to the Republicans.
That is a pickup of seats in the House, okay, yeah.
That's
between
right.
40 and 80, 80 would be huge.
Huge. By contrast, there were 55 in 94 for Bill Clinton, and I believe in 1938, the modern record was FDR lost 71 Democrats, so it's very likely to land somewhere in between. But the bottom line is these polls are becoming, despite sort of vagaries like cell phone usage, I think with some degree of certainty, there is a notion that Republicans are going to win between 40 and 80 in the House and somewhere between 4 and 9 in the Senate. I think the Senate is a far more difficult institution to predict.
Four, of course, would mean Democrats continue to hold it. Nine would mean Republicans. Peter Baker, your paper is reporting on the Alaskan situation where Murkowski and Joe Miller, Tea Party versus, old mainline GOP, could split the vote and put a Democrat in. How do you see the situation on the Senate at this point, Peter?
Well, the Senate's the real question, obviously, at this point, because, in fact, you only need 39, a net change of 39 seats in the House, and everybody thinks that that number is going to be higher than that. Everybody's really watching to see the Senate, whether it gets just enough. Most people, I think, are predicting around the 8 to 9 seat pickup. They clearly, have a shot at getting the Senate. Remember, what's interesting to me is both in 1994 and in 2006, when we had radio programs like this the day before the election, all of us sat there and said, well, it's probably going to be one House, but not both Houses. And in both cases, it was both Houses. So you never know how a wave election is going to turn out that way. You could play it out in a couple different ways.
Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, and George. George, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to respond to the Republican claims that they're good on fiscal issues. If you Google or search online for national debt by U.S. presidents, you'll quickly come up with numbers that show the percentage of national debt increase as a percentage of GDP. And the last five Republican terms, Ronald Reagan's terms, George H.W. Bush's terms, George W. Bush's terms, all have incredibly high percentages, from 7% to 20% increase in national debt as a percentage of GDP. If you look at recent Democratic presidents, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, in fact, any Democrat going back to World War II, they all have negative numbers, meaning the percentage, the increase in national debt as a percentage of GDP went down under those presidents. So I think that Republican claims that they're good and sustainable on these fiscal issues are just absolutely baseless. It's scary. Go look it up.
George, thanks. We'll let us pick it up. Chuck Babington, how about it? I mean, it won't be a Republican in the White House after tomorrow's election. President Obama is, as it's midterm.
That's right.
But where do we go here? I mean, you look at history and you know it well. There's a lot of truth in what our caller George says. On the other hand, there's never been this kind of fever over deficits in my memory. There's been high fever, but this seems of a different order these days.
The American public really blows hot and cold on deficit spending, and sometimes they just ignore it. It'll go down to, 10th or 11th most important issue, and right now it's high. George makes valid points. There are, mitigating circumstances where the economy has an awful lot to do with the revenue, government revenue and deficit spending, and wars and that kind of thing can make a big difference. But generally speaking, Republicans say they want to cut taxes and cut spending. The history is it's always much easier to cut taxes. They tend to do that. They tend not to cut spending very much. Democrats are somewhat more open to taxes, somewhat higher taxes, and that brings in more revenue. So that's partly has to do with what George was talking about there. There is a lot of public angst now about deficit spending. President Obama will have to address that with what we think will be a mixed Congress. I think they will do some nipping and tucking here and there. But the agenda that we heard John Boehner lay out earlier is not very specific. When you try to get down to exactly what government program you'd be willing to cut, neither party is very eager to answer that question.
Peter, $100 billion is the number that John Boehner and Republicans use as their goal to cut. Of course, real deficit hawks say that's not nearly enough. Out of this commission reporting on December 1st, can you see an agenda emerging that these two parties might work on together or that might get through even if they don't work together, Peter?
Well, I think if you put two rational, politicians in a room, a Republican and Democrat, and you ask them, okay, off the record, what is the solution to deficit spending, they would not be that far apart in understanding what it would take. The question is whether, in fact, the environment will allow them to do what they know ought to be done, and that includes a variety of things. Whether it be, cutbacks in entitlement benefits, tax increases, raising the retirement age, cutting back on some of the defense spending, and so forth. Those are it's not a big secret as to the kinds of things, that structural changes that need to be made in the budget. The question is whether or not anybody has the political will to do it, and whether they have the political trust in each other to hold hands, Republican, Democrat, together and jump off that cliff together, rather than worrying that they're going to come up.
We may come up short. Peter Baker with the New York Times, Glenn Thrush, Politico, Chuck Babington, AP, standby. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Sue in Columbia, South Carolina. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to request whole country right now, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, just be aware exactly what is going to happen if the Republicans take over. Billions and billions of dollars have been poured in the advertisement, so we are basically selling our country to the outsiders.
What do you mean outsiders? I mean Republicans.
Like, you know, the outside countries, that they have their own interest of getting the jobs from United States to other countries.
You saw the news, Obama's people saying, you know, foreign money and Chamber of Commerce, and now that's the way you look at the Republican whole effort?
Well, only thing is we're going to find out eventually, that's exactly why would you pour millions of dollars just because you love this country so much?
Sue, let us look at the jobs issue. I mean, Chuck, first, just, we all see how allegations stick. I mean, this came from David Axelrod and the president himself a few weeks ago on the Chamber of Commerce front. You know, what's panned out on that, the accusation of foreign money in these elections? And then let's look at jobs. Everybody talks about them. Agenda-wise, what might be coming on that front, Chuck?
Well, the Chamber of Commerce denied it, and very little panned out in terms of proof. I think at the end of the day, we'll find that the money that went into campaigns in both parties this year was overwhelmingly, if not entirely, domestic money. There's plenty of incentive for all types of interest groups in this country to pour money into campaigns, even in a non-presidential year.
So turn to jobs. Everybody talks about them. What, if anything, if it's not going to be stimulus, and the Obama administration says, you know, we saved this country, maybe the world, from a Great Depression with the stimulus that we brought, but unemployment's still 6%.
Economists will tell you that the government, even a powerful federal government like we have in this country, can do only so much about big economic issues such as jobs. The stimulus, again, that as I mentioned earlier, was not very popular with the public, probably did save some jobs and create some jobs. Economists will say that. But at the end of the day, the government can affect big economic terms only so much, and almost every reputable economist is predicting a slow recovery in the employment picture in America. And I think, you know, by the next election, the next presidential election, we're still going to see unemployment in this country, maybe not as high as it is now, but still by historical terms, still pretty high.
Peter Baker, we've been looking across the pond at the UK with their parliamentary system. They're going very aggressively at spending and raising taxes. They're going at that fiscal deficit. If this country with this new Congress can't do that because of gridlock, and it can't, you know, bring another stimulus on, and some still say that there wasn't enough, Paul Krugman saying there wasn't enough, what does that mean? Are we just sort of paralyzed and the economy will do whatever it does, period?
Well, that's a really good question. I do think that the austerity politics you're seeing coming out of Europe these days, not just in England, but you saw in France with the pension law and so mm-hmm. forth, is an interesting political dynamic. Usually, obviously, Europe is looked at by American politics as a place of big government and sometimes socialism and so forth, and now they're going to provide a different model the other direction. I've heard people in the White House even say that will create increased pressure on them and on Congress in this next 2 years to follow suit. If obviously Europe can tighten their belt, so can we. Difference, of course, is that Europe has a much bigger social safety net, much bigger presence of
in the first
some
place.
Of these government programs to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think you have some very, very fundamentally different ideas about economics coming to the fore in these next 2 years with two different power centers in Washington, and reconciling them isn't easy. You could definitely predict a couple years of paralysis on this. On the other hand, the situation is so bad that, you know, there's great incentive for them to put aside their differences and find a way to come together because the economy obviously hurts both of them.
Let's go to New York, East Hampton, New York, and Neil. Neil, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the problems that just nobody seems to talk about and no one addresses is that for the last 15 years, the private sector stopped creating jobs. And when you look at the job creation under Bush and you look at it, you know, at the end of the Clinton era, you see that most of the jobs being created in the public sector. And so when you talk about stimulus, if the private sector doesn't create jobs and it's a structural fault in the economy, then the only thing that does create jobs is the stimulus. And that's our problem. Nobody deals with the structural faults that have now, you know, become endemic to American society.
And everybody's worried about that. Neil, I appreciate your call. Glenn Thrush, what about it? I mean,
That is, I think, the dominant point that overhangs everything, is that the last two sort of business cycles we had were sort of constructed on untenable bubbles. We had the Internet boom, and then we had sort of this combination of service industry expansion, consumer over-expenditure, and this finance and mortgage bubble. I think that that's a fundamental point.
If I may stand there for one second, Glenn, I mean, the problem there is if the Republicans take the House or Senate, I don't know, both, I mean, their message is free the private sector, you know, let it do what it does best. Let it, you know, gun the economy, let it create jobs. You're saying, what, that may not work?
Well, I don't think we have a sustained. I think the question, and this was a question that was raised during the height of the financial crisis, and it has not been sufficiently answered as we've sort of gotten down into the weeds of our politics, and that is, how do you deal with this question of what the American economy fundamentally does? And this was something that Obama attempted to address, I think, in a half-hearted way in the stimulus with this creation. It's not half-hearted to have $80 billion, but $80 billion investment, for instance, in green energy.
Well, even the clip we played of him today, the businesses of tomorrow, you know, look, will come where there's the best infrastructure, the best research and technology. That's that kind of structural approach, I guess.
Right, but, you know, I have a story up today that sort of talks about the stimulus and people sort of viewing it as Obama's original sin, the fact that this became, because of the political priorities, a mishmash of priorities, including a tax cut that he doesn't get credit for and doesn't seem to have had very much of a stimulative effect. So I think your caller's larger question about where does the economy go is not likely to be answered by the political process.
Let's go to Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is about the concern with gridlock taking place if the Democrats lose a great deal of House, seats in the House, and what the potential in the Senate might be. But our Senator Lindsey Graham has tried working with the Democrats, and he's gotten lambasted by his own party for doing so. So what kind of encouragement do the Republicans have, and, you know, what the encouragement is there then for both parties to work together?
That chance in the middle. Let us look at it, Beth. I appreciate your call. One more, maybe on that front, Fayetteville, North Carolina. James, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was wanting to ask, somebody mentioned earlier about the climate after the election. Is there any indicators now that the climate will be more for collaboration, regardless of, you know, which party takes the way? Is this kind of, you know, just a bunch of rhetoric now to get people in seats, or is this an indicator for another tough year?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure I hear that much rhetoric toward collaboration, but what about it, Peter Baker? I mean, we've heard Mitch McConnell saying that he might be willing to work with President Obama if he's willing to do a Clintonian backflip, go, you know, tack more to the center. Is there a scenario, Peter, in which you can see the Barack Obama, President Obama deciding and congressional Republicans deciding, you know what, we'd better find some space in the middle to get some things done here?
Well, I do think you should discount to some extent some of the things that are said during a campaign, because obviously they are, as the caller pointed out, intended to divide people, intended to get people motivated to go out to vote against somebody else as much as vote for somebody. And very few people go to the polls because they want to vote for, you know, working together, unfortunately. But I think that, you know, the question is whether the atmosphere is fundamentally different today than it has been under previous cycles. And, you know, you can certainly make the argument that we're further away than ever in terms of being able to see the sort of collaboration that you used to see after elections, after a very tough fight. At the same time, you know, there's so much at stake, there's so much on the table, and if, in fact, Republicans control one or both houses of Congress, they're going to have some responsibility to govern. President Obama told us in an interview that, in fact, he was optimistic the Republicans would want to work with him after the election. We'll see. Both sides have said, basically, I want to work with the other guy as long as he does what I want.
Yeah.
So the question is, at some point, whether they can kind of bridge that.
Healthcare is huge. Chuck Babington, what about it? I mean, the Republicans, you know, Pledge to America says repeal and replace healthcare, what they like to call Obamacare. If the veto of the president hangs over them, is there anything they can do on that front?
They can try to nibble at the edges, Tom, by trying to block some spending to implement the program. I don't think they can do very much. It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out, whether, as the Democrats have predicted for some time, that as months and maybe even another year or so go by, that more Americans will see some benefits. Traditionally, Americans like to get extra benefits from the government. We haven't seen that play out in the health care bill yet, but not much of it has been rolled out. And the other point I would make, your last two callers really made excellent points. You know, we talk about gridlock. You know, let's look at what happened in the last 2 years. The Democrats had a huge majority in the House, and for a while, after Arlen Specter went over to the Democrats and before Ted Kennedy died, they had a filibuster-proof margin in the Senate, which is very rare in this country. And look at what did not get accomplished. Now, they had the Democrats had to compromise a lot on the health care bills, for example, not the public option that the president had had campaigned on. And they didn't even touch big issues like Social Security, Medicare, and immigration.
Let's go to Mary in Northampton, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. No one has mentioned the wars in which we are engaged. When we went to war, taxes were cut. Now, if I were going on a big spending spree in my home, I certainly would not cut.
You'd put aside some money to cover it, ideally.
Well, absolutely, wouldn't you? And we are in a huge deficit, and nobody has mentioned the war, how much it is costing us, and I think that's a huge issue. I also have another point. I think we should institute the draft, and everybody in this country would serve, and then maybe we wouldn't go into wars that are quagmires.
You might see a change in
the air.
Thank you, Mary. You might see a change of tenor in a hurry. Peter Baker, what about the wars? They barely registered on a lot of campaign trails this year.
Yeah.
What about the agenda when it comes to Iraq, Afghanistan, post midterms?
No, it's very striking. Obviously, the last couple cycles both had such a large focus on the wars. They've been a part of our conversation in this country now for 9 years, and yet you have heard zero. I mean, the caller is exactly right about that in this campaign. Partly that's because things in Iraq obviously have calmed down. Things are going well enough that President Obama's withdrawal of 100,000 troops from there has not allowed the violence to tick back up to where it had been in the past. And obviously in Afghanistan, the moment of truth is really going to come next summer, when the president's promise to begin pulling troops out is tested against the reality on the ground. I think you might see more conversation in the next election about Afghanistan than you have in this one. But with the economy overhanging things, that's just been issue one for everybody.
But no real change if Congress changes on war policy?
If Congress changes, you can have an interesting dynamic. I mean, the Republicans have been more supportive of a president's surge in Afghanistan, for instance, than the Democrats, where 100 Democrats in the House voted against the most recent war funding bill. And so, you know, there's an interesting marriage of interest there, but the promise to begin withdrawing them in the summer is what might pull them apart. And, we're going to see where things are on the ground at that point, whether it justifies pulling troops out and whether the president does it on a pace that would cause, the debate to kind of come back to the fore.
Glenn, look at immigration for just a second. How does this play? Do the Democrats push on it because it might help them in 2012 or stay away from it?
Before I do that, let me just quickly circle back to Peter's point. I think just one quick point on Afghanistan. I think the result, the pressure on the administration on the deficit is going to continue to sort of, I think, motivate them to a quicker rather than later withdrawal from Afghanistan in order to save money. But on immigration, I think the dynamic in the Senate is pretty critical. If Harry Reid loses, as the polls seem to indicate, though the race is extremely volatile, it is somewhat likely that his successor will be Chuck Schumer from New York, who has been at loggerheads with the White House over the sequencing of immigration versus energy. Schumer thinks immigration is a winner for Democrats around the country, particularly in the Southwest. He thinks he wants to capitalize on sort of the emerging Latino minority in some of these states, and I think you would see this pretty interesting dynamic of there being a good deal more fervor for pushing immigration, at least as an issue, perhaps not with the hopes of a positive outcome in the Senate. And I've heard some Democrats surmise that they expect John McCain to turn back into John McCain once he wins this election and play some sort of a constructive role in immigration reform, though I think that's very much up in the air.
Peter Baker, take us back to the president one more time here and how you see the White House on the other side of these votes. Let's say Republicans make very significant gains, if they do. Do we see a President Obama who learned that trying to work with the Republicans wasn't worth it, so he comes out, as you know, the sort of more than ever, sort of the fighting principled president? Or do we see the Bill Clinton-style triangulation? Is there room for that in this Congress? Is there room for that in President Obama's character?
Well, it's a good question. I think that he has, you know, I think there is an instinct in him that believes in the idea of working together. What Republicans would tell you is that he didn't really make as serious an effort at that at the beginning of his tenure as they had hoped he might. And of course, he did remember tell Eric Cantor, the House Republican, one of the House Republican leaders, in a meeting early on, who had presented him some ideas. He says, "Look, you know, I won." And in other words, they came out of an election feeling that they had a mandate to do certain things. They don't have that mandate at the moment if this election tomorrow turns out to be what people think it is. And so, you know, that in any White House is a moment of humility and recalibration. And I think this president is searching right now for ways to reformulate and correct course in his administration without retreating from any of the big principles that he believes in.
A lot of votes already in, millions more to come in midterm elections right across the country tomorrow. And a lot at stake there, though maybe gridlock in no small part. We'll see those outcomes and hope we get to talk with each of you again about them. Peter Baker with the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Glenn Thrush at Politico, senior White House reporter. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
And Charles Babington, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Chuck, it's always great to have you. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Vote. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.